Linda Moulton Howe, she's an Emmy Award-winning television producer, investigative reporter, and author. She goes right to the men and women at the forefront of science and environmental challenges. Her website, earthfiles.com. She's on a major story now talking about underwater images and side-scanning radar of an F-89 on the bottom of Lake Superior. Major story, Linda, and let's get right into it.
Well, thanks, George.
Sure.
You know, it was just recently that the Great Lakes Dive Company in Michigan announced that it has discovered an F-89 on the bottom of Lake Superior, and about 200 feet from the jet is a mysterious object shaped a bit like a teardrop. Could these underwater finds help answer what happened 53 years ago? On November 23, 1953, when Michigan's Kinross Air Force Base launched an F-89 to investigate a rapidly moving UFO on radar. That night, American Air Force radar operators watched the radar blip of the F-89, it was carrying two men, merge with another radar blip of the unidentified flying object. Back then, the most prominent investigator of government information about UFOs was Major Donald Kehoe, U.S. Marine Corps, and former director of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena that was known as NICAP. Major Kehoe wrote five books beginning in 1950, with one entitled The Flying Saucers Are Real, which was published only 3 years after the famous Roswell disc crash headlines that the government tried to turn into a weather balloon. Well, 10 years later, in 1960, when Major Kehoe wrote Flying Saucers Top Secret, he was frustrated by the ever-tightening censorship and outright lies, as he called them, that had become the strictly enforced policy of what Kehoe called the silence group in the government. 2 years before that book's release, he had been surprised in 1958 when the U.S. Air Force at Lackland Air Force Base in Texas sent him a script for a closed-circuit radio broadcast at that base. Lackland wanted Major Kehoe's permission to use some of his book material. Well, that 1958 U.S. Air Force script began with a detailed description of what happened during the Kinross F-89's encounter with a UFO on November 23rd of 1953, which was a complete contrast to the Air Force's original public explanation that a Canadian airliner had crashed. Coast listeners can right now see a reprint of that Lackland Air Force Base closed-circuit radio script at my news website, earthfiles.com. You go to www.earthfiles, and there is a hot link at the top of the headlines page to my Earth Files report about this Lake Superior F-89 discovery, and in it is this amazing script from the Air Force. Now, in his book, Major Kehoe included this script as well, and what I'm going to share right now are some brief quotes that relate to this F-89, perhaps, at the bottom of Lake Superior that has been discovered. The script began with the Air Force no longer arguing about whether there were UFOs. It said, "Where do they come from? All sightings mentioned are authenticated as described in this broadcast." And then they say, "It was the evening of November 23, 1953, and wintry darkness had settled over Michigan. At an isolated radar station, air defense operators were watching their scope in a routine guard against possible enemy attack." With full details, that official U.S. Air Force script then showed how radar operators had picked up the blip of an unknown object over the Sioux Locks near Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. Since this was a restricted area, an F-89 jet from Kinross Air Force Base south of Sault Ste. Marie was immediately sent to investigate with a crew of two men. The script continued, quote, "The UFO flying as fast as a jet airliner was heading toward Lake Superior. At over 500 miles an hour, the F-89 raced after it out across Whitefish Bay. 9 minutes ticked by. Slowly, the jet closed in. The plane was followed by radar until it merged with an object 70 miles off Keweenaw Point in Upper Michigan. A stunned radar officer was quoted as saying, quote, "It seems incredible, but the blip apparently just swallowed our F-89. No trace was ever found of the missing men, the F-89, or the UFO," unquote. Official U.S. Air Force never broadcast script. And now, half a century later, recently released Shark 2 side-scan sonar and remote-operated vehicle images taken a year ago in August and September 2005 might help answer the question, what happened to the Kinross F-89 swallowed up on radar by a UFO? A couple of weeks ago, I interviewed Adam Jimenez, project manager for the Great Lakes Dive Company. Adam received a Bachelor's of Science Computer Engineering degree in 1990 from the Kettering Technical School in Michigan, run by General Motors. He is also a master diver who has a certificate with rebreather apparatus. He explained that in the year 2000, he and his colleagues formed their dive business to look for shipwrecks on the bottom of the deepest of the Great Lakes, which is Lake Superior. The original goal for Great Lakes Dive Company was not to salvage what they find, but to videotape discoveries for documentary productions. Originally in 2005, what the company was searching for were two Canadian-French minesweepers that sank off the Keweenaw Peninsula of Michigan. Problems arose with their side-scan radar, which had to be repaired. And when it was ready to work again, it was too late to resume the minesweeper search, so they took a run at the last known coordinates of the Kinross F-89 that was also off Keweenaw Peninsula. And here now is Adam Jimenez to describe what happened.
We went out to the general vicinity of the last known radar contact, and we began sweeping the area with our sonar array that is capable of searching a wide area. For people who don't know a lot about sonar equipment, most sonar equipment is very narrow. You will search about a 1,500-foot section of lake bed at a time, and it takes a long time to mow, as they say, the lawn back and forth, sweeping with sonar. Ours is a wide-range sonar. It's capable of looking over a wide area. It took us basically 5 or 6 days of sweeping until we got the hit on the F-89. Or what appeared to be the F-89, we didn't know until we looked at it a little closer. There was a lot of emptiness down there. And, you know, there weren't any wrecks in the immediate area. And so it's a lot of flat lake bottom, and you get this shape that just kind of appears out of that. So the anomaly kind of stands right out at you. And, of course, I think several of us jumped up and said, what is that? You know, back up, hold up, you know. Did we say that's the F-89? No, we didn't know at that point until we were able to rescan with a high resolution and take some measurements.
And so then you think it's probably the F-89 from the 1953 Kinross incident. How did you then find that other mysterious object?
Well, when we went back and got the image, the high-res image of the F-89, we immediately dropped the ROV in the water to look at the F-89 to hopefully get a serial number off the tail, which was exactly what we did, and also to get visual confirmation that it was the F-89 from other things, like what type of wing pod does it have, what type of canopy does it have, anything to give us a clue that this was an F-89 and what made us focus on the object when it began causing problems with our equipment. There's just a huge story there, and not to mention the story leading up what happened in 1953.
What were the problems with your equipment?
Well, we didn't note the object at first until we began a detailed scan, what we call a high-resolution scan of the area, basically trying to find the wing and any other missing parts we could find. There was one corner of the search grid that was sending back a visual distortion, and it was only on that corner of the search grid. We could drag the sonar fish over the F-89 and get an image, for a sonar image anyway, clear as a bell, which is what you see on our website. But when we would drag the sonar fish over that particular location of the object, we would get a visual distortion. The mystery object, as we refer to it, it was kind of strange, and we didn't know if we were having a reoccurring problem with our sonar array. So we began focusing our imaging equipment on that portion of the grid, which was several hundred feet away from the aircraft. It's still distorted. We would take the unit back to the F-89. It would not distort. We'd take the unit back over to the corner. It would distort. One of the team members recalled that F-89s were equipped at one point with nuclear weapons. This prompted us to pull everything out of the water and return to Michigan and obtain a Geiger counter. We were concerned we might be dealing with a radioactive source. We did that. We got a hold of a handheld Geiger counter, put it inside the ROV, sent the ROV to the bottom, and the results were negative. There was no radiation coming from the object.
Any speculation by you all about what is that interference? What's causing the interference?
Well, again, we thought radiation at first because it was almost a mimic of, if you've ever had a cellular phone turned on next to a computer monitor and get a phone call, you'll see it distorting in the monitor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what we were looking at on the images that we were getting, was that sort of visual distortion. So we thought we might be dealing with some form of radiation, but we eliminated that. We still don't know. We haven't been back since with the Shark system, our big sonar array. We simply captured the images we captured on the sonar system to get what we've got. But it would be an interesting test to go back next season and use the Shark array and find out exactly what's causing that distortion.
In the side scan imaging, what can you describe in more detail about the teardrop-shaped object?
What can I tell you about it? We don't know what it is. We're not ufologists. We are divers and scientists. The ROV footage shows that it's clearly metallic. It doesn't show up on a regular magnometer scan, which doesn't necessarily mean anything. It just means it's not made out of iron. It definitely has the reflective qualities of metal, so I would call it metallic. There has been some speculation on the Internet that it is dented in the front. In fact, it is not dented in the front. It appears to be a distortion on the side scan image. So it's very smooth and metallic in shape and fairly large.
Could you please give some of the measurements that you know, the distance between the plane and that teardrop-shaped object and the estimated size of the teardrop-shaped object?
The distance between the two objects is approximately 212 feet, and I believe the size of the teardrop is roughly 8 feet by 15 feet, but that's just the exposed portion. We don't know what else lies beneath the sand.
And so you're saying that the teardrop itself is not more than 15 feet in diameter?
It's not diameter because it's in oblong kind of shape. From what we can tell, what's exposed is about a 15 by 8 foot section. Now, who knows what else is underneath?
Mm-hmm.
What you're seeing in the side scan is from the tail to the tip is about 15 feet. And from the absolute widest point of the teardrop across, I believe, is 8 to 10 feet somewhere in there.
Are there any instruments that you can use that can say what this is made out of?
No. As I said, it doesn't show up on a magnometer, and that's pretty much what you're the only thing you can use without actually getting into recovering the object.
But if it doesn't have iron, it's not going to have a signature in a magnetometer?
Right. Magnetometers are essentially huge magnets. Anybody who's had a magnet knows that sometimes they attract metal, sometimes they don't, and this one does not give a reading on a magnometer.
Now, in the original story that was released from the Air Force and the media at the time, the Air Force said that there was an object identified as a UFO traveling over 500 miles an hour that the F-89 was racing toward out across Whitefish Bay, and that they watched on radar as the blips between the F-89 and the UFO that was traveling rapidly came together and joined into one blip. One of the quotes from that period of time was from the Air Force, "The blip apparently just swallowed the F-89. No trace was ever found of the missing men, the F-89, or the UFO." And that was a quote from a report.
Correct.
So you would think that whatever this object was, the blip that seemed to swallow the F-89, it would have to be bigger than an F-89.
The aircraft disappeared at 7,000 feet also. The aircraft that we found doesn't appear to have hit the lake from a fall of 7,000 feet. The wreckage that we found would certainly not suggest the plane fell from an altitude of 7,000 feet.
And so there really is a substantial mystery about what this teardrop-shaped object is down there a few hundred feet from the F-89.
Absolutely, a tremendous mystery.
And when we come back, George, we'll go into what might happen between Great Lakes Dive Company and Canada, because this all lies in Canadian territory.
What an incredible story. And Whitefish Bay, of course, has a lot to do with the old Edmund Fitzgerald sinking from 1975. Do you remember that one?
You can tell me about it after the break.
You got a deal. We'll be back in a moment with Linda Moulton Howe. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie at the OnStar Studios in Detroit, along with Linda Moulton Howe, who is where she is. Linda, have you ever been to the Motor City?
Yes, a long time ago, but I've never been to those fascinating Sioux Locks at St. Marie, which, when you realize that for over a century, they have allowed that all that boat traffic in and out of Lake Superior and the other lakes.
Well, you know, I was saying the Edmund Fitzgerald sank back in November 10th, 1975, took 29 sailors with that ship when it went down in the icy winds of November. And they were headed for Whitefish Bay, of all places. But this story that you're following now of this craft, it is really fascinating. I mean, how do you dig these up, Linda? How do they come?
Well, I think everybody became aware of the news that was breaking on the net, 2 weeks ago, when the images first surfaced. And I was surprised when I first talked with Adam that it goes all the way back a year ago. That's when they did this underwater. And many people have called and emailed me to ask, well, why has nothing happened to salvage the F-89 and whatever this teardrop-shaped mystery object is? And Adam told me that the mystery object that caused this microwave-like distortion on their side-scan sonar is what just stopped them in their tracks. They need Canadian government approval if they do try to salvage, which, remember, was never their original goal, and they don't want anybody getting in there and messing it up. And so far, the Canadian government hasn't given the okay. And now, as we continue in this second half hour, Adam describes what has happened so far and what they hope they can do.
The Great Lakes Dive Company would have simply sent the GPS coordinates of the aircraft to the U.S. Air Force so they could retrieve their airmen had it not been for the object. Certainly, that's what we would do with the minesweepers once they are located. We would provide the coordinates to the appropriate agencies who may want to recover their officers. But the object changed everything, so that kind of puts us in a holding pattern with everything.
Meaning that you would like to have a closer identification, perhaps, of what the object is?
Correct.
And you would do that in 2007 in what way?
Well, we would take the ROV back down. We looked at most of the site. We'd like to look a little bit further. We were hampered by worsening weather in the middle of the lake, so we weren't really able to finish what we would like to finish. And there's been some suggestion by the team to utilize what they call a high-pressure wash system on the ROV, which basically generates a stream of water capable of dusting the silt off of things and possibly taking a run at the object with that system. We don't know. We're still working out the logistics.
Mm-hmm. And if you could then spray off some of the coating of the mud and the silt, you might be able to see more clearly what that object is.
Correct.
And you would do this videotaping as you went?
Absolutely. Well, as much as we could. Whenever you use a high-pressure wash system, it tends to stir up silt quite a bit. So there may be a lot of waiting and seeing afterwards.
Have you had any contact from any military agency to date about this?
No, no military agencies. The only contacts we've had are routine contacts with the Canadian government regarding permits to the site, which is not sinister in the slightest. It's routine. The Canadian government believes anything on the lake bottom is their property, and especially something that hasn't been reported as being discovered, they like to know what the location is before they're willing to issue a permit to return. We have other projects in the works. It forces us to kind of keep a delicate peace with the Minister of Culture in Canada so that nothing else gets disrupted.
So currently where the F-89 and the round object lay is in Canadian territory?
That's correct.
And if this round object turns out to fall into the category of a silver disc, as was photographed so many times in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, what do you think would be the next step as far as you being able to do something about retrieving it or working with the Canadian government? And what would the U.S. government perhaps say?
Well, I think the U.S. government, unless they could show that the object is their property, I don't think would have much of a say in the object itself. Of course, the F-89 remains the U.S. Air Force property, which is fully understandable. But the Canadian government is very restrictive, as I mentioned. They consider everything on the lake bottom, be it a shipwreck, a plane, or something else unknown, their property automatically. So anything, any kind of recovery effort to be done legally would have to be done through the Canadian government, unless, of course, the U.S. could prove that the object was their property, which I have no idea. If I knew what it was, I might say, well, yeah, that's, you know, a piece of military hardware. Maybe they know something we don't.
The size is puzzling, but currently, if the part that we're seeing is only a upper portion of something that might be bigger underneath, that could be a whole other story?
Certainly. The speculation can run the spectrum from one end to the other of what it is and how big it is. One of our team suggested that perhaps it's upside down. Perhaps we're seeing the bottom of whatever that is. It's possible it's a piece of something. The rest of it may be someplace else. We just don't know. It's wide open for rampant speculation at this point without further analysis.
And about that issue of the F-89 not looking like it had fallen from 7,000 feet, it reminds me of the famous Mantell case over Kentucky, in which they found that plane broken up with thousands of little holes in it. One of the statements was that it didn't look like it crashed. It looked like it had been sort of placed and cracked apart. And this raises a question about this interaction with UFO activity, that there are allegedly beams or electromagnetic fields that might place a plane down in the bottom of water without the plane actually falling.
Anything is possible at this point, Linda. If I had to guess, I'd say the plane experienced a low-level collision with the object that's near it. The forensics of the aircraft suggest that it was a low-level, low-speed collision with something. There does appear to be what we refer to as a strike mark on the object that does match the hole where the wing used to be on the F-89. There's an oblong kind of unique shape where the wing used to be. And there's I don't know if you would call it a scratch per se. It's definitely not a dent. But it's a matching formation on the object that matches the hole where the wing was. So if I had to guess, my best guess would be that a low-level collision took place and both objects went to the bottom.
And when you talk about that scratch, you mean that there is a scratch on the round or teardrop-shaped object?
Right. I call it a strike mark because I don't know if you'd call it a scratch. It doesn't appear to be an indentation of any kind in the metal. It's just a oblong mark that does match the oddball oblong mark on the F-89. If you can imagine a wing being ripped off of an airplane, it's going to leave a very distinguished hole. It's not going to be a simple laser cut, you know, precision line, if you will. It's going to leave a strange shape because of the twisting metal and whatnot. Well, this shape does appear to match with the mark on the object. From those two things, the strike mark and the hole in the F-89, I would speculate that the F-89 did collide with this object in some manner.
And both went down to the bottom of Lake Superior?
That would be our guess, yes. Now, that's assuming that this isn't just a piece of something, but it would appear that both things went to the bottom in their entirety. It doesn't appear to be a broken-off piece of something, but again, we don't know. We don't know how much is below the surface.
And that wing from the F-89 might still be there under the bottom mud, or it might be under that object?
It's a possibility. There's several theories about what may have happened to the wing. That is certainly one of them, that it could be under the object itself or nearby, just buried under mud that we can't see. We're not sure.
If it really is a silver disc in the UFO category, what do you think happens next?
That's a good question. I'm not sure.
And that's what we would all like to know, isn't it, George?
Oh, Linda, I got to tell you, I'm looking at earthfiles.com right now in the two pictures, the one of the scorpion and then this teardrop-shaped object, and listening to your guest just try to relate what happened. This really is unbelievable. They've got to go down there. That's probably going to be the only way we can figure out what happened to the scorpion and what the heck this other object is.
Exactly, and what intrigues me especially is that if you go back into some of those reports in the 50s off of the coast of Florida, for example, and in the 60s, there were a lot of these so-called merging of radar blips in stories and reports in which it was assumed that whatever the unidentified was swallowed up, as that U.S. Air Force script used the term, swallowed up our jet. Well, now we're facing the possibility that whatever happened in the air, that the jet went down to the bottom of Lake Superior and that something that it collided with might be down there. And if it is only 15 feet in diameter, it couldn't have absorbed, you wouldn't think, the jet. And if it is only the top or the bottom of a much larger object, as they have speculated might be the possibility, what is there? And the next most intriguing thing they could do is at least go down there with something like fire hose kind of water and be able to blow off the muck that is on that mystery object and see. Right now, it appears to be smooth and they think metallic. Well, if they could do that much and keep blowing the water off and let it settle, even if they couldn't salvage, maybe they would be able to determine what it is that way. And if it does turn out to be some kind of smooth, polished silver disc still sitting there, what, George, do you think our government and the Canadian government would do?
I'm not so sure we would find out about it, Linda, if that is indeed the case. Let me ask you something. When I look at this object, the teardrop-shaped object, with its triangular-shaped slide mark to the right, what are the possibilities that that may be maybe part of a yacht or a small ship, and, you know, and that's the front part of it? Is that possible?
Well, anything, as he said, is possible. It's truly an open-ended mystery, and until somebody gets back down there to at least blow off the muck, we will not know. And now the big question for them, for Great Lake Dive Company, and for all of us is, will the Canadian government join in the curiosity of finding out? And if they join in the curiosity, since it's in their territory, it's not in U.S. territory, and the Canadians are very strict about where their territory is and anything that's on the bottom, the Canadian government automatically claims as their own. And in this case, would they help the Great Lakes Dive Company go down there to do the next phase of trying to identify the mystery object? And then would the Canadian government step in? And depending upon what might be discovered next June or July, when the weather gets better again, and hopefully they will have the bureaucratic papers in place, if something extraordinary is found, we're on brand new territory in terms of a public act that would be videotaped. And then what would the governments do if in fact it turns out to be something that is not normally found in the bottom of Lake Superior?
And you think the Great Lakes Dive Company, do they have the capability of getting this done if the green light was given?
Yes. I'm convinced that these people know what they're doing when it comes to getting down and looking for objects deep. that's what they want to specialize in. But until this mystery object, their goal had been largely to find and then videotape. They wanted to find historic objects in which there was some paper trail or something in history, and then turn them into stories for television and for other purposes for documentary. That is what they have come together to do. And now the mystery object stands there as a possibility of a link to that dramatic 1953 Kinross incident, which, as I outlined in the beginning, the very fact that the United States Air Force first tried again to spin an explanation about a crashed Canadian airliner, and then by 1958, 5 years later, that they privately had written a script, that they brought Major Kehoe into their inside knowledge and let him read the script and ask for him to give excerpts from his own books, and that this was to be a closed-circuit radio broadcast at Lackland Air Force Base in Texas. Who exactly was to be the closed-circuit audience? And why is it that that radio broadcast so prepared? And when you read it, I've got the entire script that goes beyond Kinross in my book, Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 2, High Strangeness. And when you read the entire script that was to be shared, it goes into so many other military encounters and chases with multiple UFOs in the skies, not only in the United States, but in other parts of the world. What was happening that the government of the United States was moving forward, at least with testing within its own ranks, a very detailed, very straightforward script that went on for some time on many cases that had been kept away from the public and the media.
And I don't know what is the stranger of the two, the scorpion going down, the object next to it, or a combination of both of them.
Right, because you would assume that the advanced technology was never going to go down, quote unquote,
exactly.
With an earthly terrestrial airplane. So what is laying down there at the bottom of Lake Superior, 212 feet from what has now clearly been identified as an F-89C Scorpion?
I'm George Norrie, live at the OnStar Studios in Detroit, Michigan, on Coast to Coast AM.